WHYY.
I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. On Monday, EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy announced proposed rules to cut CO2 emissions from power plants. McCarthy said it was about protecting health, homes, local economies, and jobs. But not everyone sees it that way, including coal companies and governors from coal-producing states. For more information about these proposals, we turn to Katie Colinari. She's energy and environment reporter for State Impact Pennsylvania and for WHYY. And Katie, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
What's the significance of yesterday's announcement?
Well, this is the first time, Marty, that the feds are going to be regulating carbon dioxide from the nation's power plants. They're a major source of greenhouse gas emissions. And one of the major parts of this announcement is that each individual state has its own target. The overall goal is to reduce emissions by 30% by the year 2030, so in about 15 years or so. But each state has its own target emissions goal that the EPA based on a variety of factors, including just what their current energy mix is like. So actually, for example, Vermont has no goal.
Is that right? They've already met the goal?
Yeah, they actually have very, very few emissions in that state. But everyone, of course, is thinking of states like Texas and Pennsylvania, which are major energy producers, coal and natural gas. So Texas has a slightly higher goal than we do. Ours is about 30% when you crunch the numbers that were put out by the EPA yesterday. Our state will actually get to draft our own plan for how to do that. There's nothing that says, you know, you have to do X and Y at a particular power plant in order to achieve this. We really are in the driver's seat, according to the EPA.
Well, it's interesting because the EPA is really giving states authority to make decisions within, I guess, a certain number of options, whether it's natural gas or cap and trade or increasing renewables or even more efficiency.
Right, exactly. And that was actually met with some skepticism from the Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett, who put out a statement yesterday really expressing his concern about what's going to happen to the coal industry. Which is, of course, a major emitter of carbon dioxide, and Pennsylvania being fourth for coal in the United States. And so he's really worried that this is going to force the closure of coal-fired power plants, and thousands of people who are working in that industry right now are going to lose their jobs, not just in Pennsylvania, but across the entire state. I had a chance to speak with his energy executive yesterday, Patrick Henderson, who, you know, when I asked him, I said, yeah, but, you know, that's really in your hands, right? That's what the EPA is saying. And he said, well, you know, sometimes we see in the past that the EPA gives us some freedom, and then they seem to take it back when all is said and done. So he was really skeptical about that flexibility that was really being touted by Gina McCarthy and President Obama yesterday.
So are environmental groups cheering?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah, they're thrilled. They see this as a really necessary step. And this is one of President Obama's key proposals for addressing climate change. So, of course, that's something that has environmentalists, you know, going gangbusters with the praise. So they're really happy about it.
So what's the timetable? I guess there's a comment period, what, for about a year?
Yes, there's going to be a public comment period. And actually, Pittsburgh is going to be the host for one of four hearings that's going to happen around the United States. That's going to happen at the end of July. And then what the EPA says it's going to do is finalize the rules by exactly a year from now, June 2015, with the goal of having all the states submit their plans by June 2016. Now, that might actually be a really ambitious timeline because this is a rule that's expected to get possibly some court challenges from coal companies, major energy-producing states. I asked Patrick Henderson, the governor's energy executive, yesterday if Pennsylvania might be one of those challengers, and he said it was definitely too soon to tell.
Oh, interesting. Well, there will be more on this issue from Radio Times and also from other news programs here at WHYY. We want to shift gears now and talk a bit about pipelines and pipeline politics in the tri-state area, especially in Chester County outside of Philadelphia and the New Jersey Pinelands, as this region becomes an energy hub. And we have two more guests who have joined our conversation. Katie Colinari staying with us for the rest of the hour. Annie Maycuth is the Philadelphia Inquirer energy reporter. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be here.
And also with us is Linda Farrell. She's executive director of the Pipeline Safety Coalition. And Linda, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty.
Let me begin with you. Tell us about what the Pipeline Safety Coalition, what your mission is.
Well, Pipeline Safety Coalition works with both communities and operators. We focus our relationships on improving public, personal, and environmental safety in pipeline issues by working with both sides of the coin with a high level of transparent education, neutral information, community mentoring. And we try to help landowners get to a more level playing field in this very confusing issue.
Well, I was reading that you, I guess, got into this issue as a landowner yourself when you discovered some, what, pipelines on your land?
I did. I moved to our property to farm, and as a farmer, I did what I did not realize was the energy protocol. If you hear a rumbling below the ground and you know that there are gas pipelines there, you should run like hell. And I did. I discovered that there was a smart pig inspection.
What is that, a smart pig inspection?
A smart pig inspection is, and as a farmer, I wondered the same thing.
Exactly.
A smart pig.
What are we talking about?
So a smart pig is a device that it runs through a gas pipeline to detect corrosion or potential breaks in a pipeline. So it's a safety mechanism for inspecting pipelines. And when it runs through the pipeline, you feel a rumble because the pipes are only really about 3 feet below the top of the soil, and a maximum of 5 feet. So you hear it and you feel the rumble of this mechanism whooshing through the pipes to inspect them for stability.
So was there a problem with pipes on your land?
There was. And so these pipes were replaced by segments in the areas that were corroded, and ultimately the pipes were replaced with great enough frequency that I couldn't farm. The soil was disturbed. They had to move my greenhouse, although the greenhouse was off the right-of-way for convenience of construction, had to be removed. And so as I was learning more about pipelines than I was farming, I also was learning that there were a number of people in the community in a pipeline expansion project who also didn't know what their rights were and what the regulations were on pipelines.
And we're talking about Chester County.
This is in Chester County.
Where you live.
Exactly.
Andy, let me turn to you and help us, I guess, understand, if we're talking about pipelines that are underground, if we're looking at this region, how extensive is the pipeline network? Do we know?
Yeah, the pipelines are public once they built them. I mean, there's maps showing where they are, and there's an extensive network throughout the area, both in bringing natural gas in and petroleum products from the refineries. Chester County is like a real rat's nest of pipelines. It's kind of the pipeline equivalent to highways in North Jersey. You know, they're just crisscrossing all over.
But all underground.
You know, you see them. I think most people aren't aware of them. There may be markers along the roads, little tags saying that there's a pipeline there, and you may be living there for years. In fact, many of them were built before a lot of population or housing was out there. So people, you know, it may be just they're aware of it like some vague thing in the neighborhood until they come through with a project. And right now there's there's been a massive shift in the way energy is produced in the country. You know, there's these shale formations in western Pennsylvania,
Absolutely.
North Dakota, other places. And so there's been a real redirection on the way fuels and need to be moved across the country. Pipelines are changing direction from the one east to west to east to move these things. And then there's new uses going in. So you have pipelines across New Jersey to a new power plant there that's gotten a lot of interest. Other natural gas pipelines in the area, you know, expanding to bring this Marcellus gas into the area. So,
and what's so interesting, I mean, I think most people know about the Keystone pipeline because there's been so much controversy and so much coverage of this, but we're talking about pipelines in our own backyard, essentially.
Sure, and Andy brings up a good point. Chester County, per se, is a real nexus of pipelines that were laid somewhere in the 1950s from Texas up to the eastern seaboard to produce fuel to carry fuel to the eastern seaboard. Chester County is consists of 1% of Pennsylvania's total square miles, and yet is ranked the third highest for density of pipelines in the state. There are 12 operators in that small county of Chester County, and in the census period from 2010 to 2012, pipeline infrastructure increased in Chester County by 6%, over 6%, while the human population decreased from 15% to 1%. So we've got a real imbalance of a county that is preserving quality of life by its plans for development, and yet the pipeline infrastructure is ramping up due to Marcellus Shale.
Well, I was going to say, Katie, does this all go back to Marcellus Shale?
Right, absolutely. There is a couple of pipelines right now that are getting a lot of attention and scrutiny. So not the Keystone XL, but right here in our backyard. The Mariner East pipeline is one of them, and as Andy mentioned before, some of these pipelines are getting switched to move now from west to east, and this is a good example of that. So the Mariner East pipeline, it's an old pipeline. It's been in the ground. Do you remember how old it is, Andy? When was it first built?
1931.
Yes, yeah. So it's been around for
80 years or so.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
So it's been around for quite some time, and of course, part of this project involves adding a new leg to that pipeline, but also replacing sections of it, that need to be replaced in order to make it viable for use today. But it's being reversed to go from west to east to bring natural gas liquids, which is propane and ethane, that's being produced in great abundance
out of
Western Pennsylvania, right. And they're bringing it to the Marcus Hook Industrial Complex, which a lot of people around here know was really hurt by the closure of a refinery there. And so that area has been repurposed now as a natural gas processing hub. And some of that is going to be exported. Some of that propane is going to be put out to local markets to, it's the kind of thing that you put in your tank to light your grill in the summer. Or possibly even heat your home in the winter. But that's another great example of one of these pipelines that's getting repurposed, but also being met with a lot of public scrutiny. One thing that comes with pipelines is additional infrastructure that's on the surface, that's above ground. Compressor stations is something that people may have heard about. In this case, the company Sunoco Logistics, which is the pipeline arm of the big energy company Sunoco, wants to put in pump and valve stations in about 31 towns across this 300-mile pipeline. And people who live in West Goshen Township in Chester County have been particularly upset about that because they want to put in this pumping station in an area that's zoned residential and kind of butts up against a residential neighborhood. And people there have been quite upset with the company's efforts to do this.
Well, I want to pick up on that after this very short break. That's Katie Colinari. She's energy and environment reporter for State Impact Pennsylvania and for WHYY. Also with us, Andy Maycuth. He's the Philadelphia Inquirer energy reporter. And Linda Farrell is with us as well. She is the executive director of the Pipeline Safety Coalition. We are not talking about the Keystone Pipeline. We are talking about the network of pipelines here in the tri-state area and what I think we could call pipeline politics as well. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America supports WHYY and Philadelphia Baroque Orchestra Tempesta di Mare's performance of Elements at the Kimmel Center on June 7th. Crackling flames, whipping winds, churning rivers, and the world emerging from chaos all make appearances in exhilarating orchestral riffs by Mare, Rebel, and Telemann. Tickets at KimmelCenter.org or 215-893-1999.
Anika Noni Rose is starring on Broadway in A Raisin in the Sun, but she'd rather be a supervillain.
I want to fly and like bite somebody in the neck and then kick somebody else. Yeah.
That's Anika Noni Rose next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. The band Clap Your Hands, Say Yeah keeps a close relationship with its fans, sometimes playing living room concerts. We'll speak with leader Alec Owensworth about the band's new CD next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Yeah.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane, talking with Linda Farrell, Andy Makuth, and Katie Colinari about pipelines here in the Philadelphia region, across the state of Pennsylvania, parts of New Jersey as well. We're also going to be talking a bit about pipeline politics and, of course, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I should add that this was a couple of weeks ago when we first started thinking about doing this show. We did ask a representative of Sunoco to join us, and they did decline our invitation. But nonetheless, Andy, let me go back to you, and even going back to what we've been talking about with these pipelines and Marcus Hook, and this idea, I guess, that Sunoco has of getting a status as a public utility, thereby sort of allowing them to have some eminent domain. Do I have that right?
Well, in the Mariner East project is that they were first asking for a public utility corporation status, then it's been changed to public utility corporation. Please don't ask me to define
it. Okay, I won't. I promise.
But in that case, in the immediate case, it's not to have eminent domain for Sunoco. It's to allow them to basically override local zoning in order to overcome any sort of obstacles about where these pumping stations would go in. So it's directed at that. Mm-hmm. The concern from opponents of that is that they would then use that status as public utility to get eminent domain for this next phase project, which was originally called Mariner East 2 and is now called the Pennsylvania Pipeline, which would be kind of a parallel pipeline to the first one.
Does your organization have a position on that?
Yes, we do. First, let me say that one of the reasons that that Sunoco is able to apply to PUC for public utility status stems to a real hodgepodge of regulations that exist at the federal level. Pipelines are cited by where they go and what they carry. So a interstate pipeline, which crosses state lines or country boundaries, is regulated for siting by the Federal Energy Regulation Commission.
FERC,
exactly. And an intrastate pipeline, gas pipeline, is within the boundaries of a state. And if it's gas, it is regulated by the operator or by the PUC, but mostly by the operator. And when you look at hazardous liquids, both interstate and Sunoco is a hazardous liquids, considered a hazardous liquids pipeline. Those inter and intrastate lines are completely regulated for unregulated for siting. The FERC does regulate hazardous liquids for tariffs, for financial regulations, but they do not regulate hazardous liquids, Sunoco, for siting. However, since, I know this is very, very convoluted, but however, since FERC does regulate Sunoco for tariffs, they are considered to be federally regulated. And because they are federally regulated, they are able to apply to PUC for status as a public utility, which gives them the ability to bypass municipal planning, which, in our opinion, goes against the grain of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania's Constitution, which in which we establish the municipal planning codes. Commonwealths are only 5 commonwealths in the nation, and that allows municipalities in different geographies with different demographics to plan their communities based on those geographies and demographics. It also flies in the face of the Supreme Court ruling, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruling, that overturned Section 27 of Act 13, which eviscerated local municipal planning authority. And so we see this as a very dangerous precedent to be set for Sunoco mm-hmm. to gain public utility status through the PUC.
And Katie, I can imagine, you know, local townships being really up in arms about this, even beyond the pipelines, but about the ability to control things within their borders.
Yeah, that's right. And actually, Andy and I have attended some of the same public meetings, particularly in West Goshen Township on this, listening, you know, for hours to people stand up and, you know, in some cases yell at the companies. They're just, people are frustrated, it's clear, because they feel like, you know, the companies sometimes they'll take one route, then they'll change. He mentioned the change in the name, which in some cases has confused the public, and so people are really frustrated about their ability to control what's happening in their own neighborhoods. Oftentimes, people don't even residents in a place say that they don't know that these things are happening until it's way too late for them to really do anything. And then they've kind of got to catch up. They've got to learn sort of this Byzantine set of regulations that Linda was just describing. So when you talk to residents or attend one of these public hearings, that's really what you hear, a lot of frustration about their lack of intimate knowledge with just how these processes work in the first place and what they can do to work with the companies to get a better result for them.
Is that what you hear too, Andy, when you go to these meetings?
Yeah, same thing. And one thing we were talking about before the show was kind of comparing what Sunoco Logistics is going through with the Mariner East project and how they've handled that and how their plans have changed sometimes in seemingly in response to public opposition and how that has really irritated the public compared to company Columbia Gas, which is building an expanded natural gas line pipeline project around Philadelphia and across into New Jersey to supply Marcellus gas to a new power plant that's going up in Deptford Township there. Mm-hmm. And in that case, there's been public opposition to it, but the plan's been laid out much more clearly, I think, and there's been a lot more outreach to public officials beforehand. And it's kind of avoided a lot of this public outrage that has blown up and I think what Sunoco Logistics is finding now is that it's very hard to reestablish public trust once people get to that stage.
Well, let me go back to you, Lynn. I mean, part of your organization, your mission is transparency, is getting information out there so that people understand that both sides, if there are sides, are talking to each other so that there's some consensus of information.
And Andy and I were talking about this earlier as well. Part of what we have done, Pipeline Safety Coalition has done, is worked with the Chester County Commissioners, and we held a public meeting a year ago in June with Columbia, the FERC, and the community, in which we had an open mic conversation. Community was able to, after hearing Columbia's proposal and FERC's explanation of the FERC process, the community was able to respond. And I will tell you, the community in Chester County has become very well educated, very savvy to the regulations and what their rights are as landowners. So the proposals that and the objections that were voiced at this community meeting were heard by Columbia, and they worked with the county, and they worked with the community, and they've worked with Pipeline Safety Coalition. And I think that's one of the reasons that their project has been a smoother project. They made changes. They made changes that the community offered up that were logical and that didn't really change the efficiency of the project.
Let me reintroduce the three of you. That's Linda Farrell. She's the executive director of the Pipeline Safety Coalition, something that she helped to start, or perhaps started all by herself a couple of years ago when she discovered that there were pipelines on her property in Chester County. Andy Maycuth is the Philadelphia Inquirer's energy reporter, and Katie Culinary, energy and environment reporter at State Impact Pennsylvania and WHYY. And we invited all three of them to join us on Radio Times to frankly get us up to speed on the pipelines that are being built and developed here in the tri-state area, and also to help us understand some of the political issues and some of the debates about where this region is going. And again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Questions or comments, give us a call or send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Katie, let me turn to you. What's interesting, it seems like what Linda's group is doing
isn't that what government should be doing, which is and essentially sort of educating people and having transparency and making sure that all parties are informed about a pipeline, for instance?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. You know, I think that that's one of the big criticisms that you hear from the public who say that they feel that in some cases the government may not have their best interests at heart. A story I recently did was about the chair of the Public Utility Commission, which now stands in place to either say yay or nay to these pump and valve stations and say yay or nay to Sunoco Logistics' request to be a public utility corporation in this case. The chair of the Public Utility Commission, he's actually also a resident of Chester County. He's a former president of the county's Chamber of Commerce. So he kind of comes to his role, I think, you know, with an economic development background. And that's something that he really cares about in this region. I know from past interviews with him. But until recently, he was a member of a group called the Greater Philadelphia Energy Action Team, which is a group that was pulled together by the Philadelphia's Chamber of Commerce to take a look at, you know, how to strategize for the Philadelphia region because, of course, you know, as Andy brought up before, we're seeing new pipelines come in. We want to be able to, you know, connect those pipelines to new business ventures, and that's sort of the goal of this group. And so knowing that he was a part of that, I asked him, you know, do you see that as a conflict of interest, particularly in this case with Sunoco Logistics? He said he, you know, didn't think so. He felt he could do his job well and kind of separate his two roles. But recently he decided to step down from that group in order to avoid the appearance of bias in this case. But there was sort of another twist to this story, which was that right as we were publishing it, Sunoco Logistics switched up its legal representation. And so now actually one of the attorneys who is representing Sunoco Logistics in the case before the PUC is a member of the Energy Action Team. So he will be standing across the podium from Robert Powelson, the chair of the PUC, defending Sunoco Logistics. And so one of the other questions is whether he will recuse himself from that vote, and that's something we still don't know.
And I guess that is the pipeline politics I've been referencing, Andy.
Yeah, I mean, there is if you pull yourself away from the effect that this has on the people in whose neighborhood these pipelines are going through, is that there's a larger economic and political issues behind it. When Sunoco Logistics originally proposed the Mariner East project, its intent was to pull ethane and propane, which are wet gases, out of the natural gas produced from western Pennsylvania. And those are higher value. They're used in petrochemical production as well as home heating or, you know, grills. But it's mostly for plastic manufacturing. As the plans are developing, a lot of that material is moving to the Gulf Coast in Texas or up to Canada. And the state, the governor's office, saw that it was important to Pennsylvania's economy to bring this or keep this stuff in Pennsylvania. Sunoco had this plan to draw it across Pennsylvania and to export it out through the port here and potentially down the road have other manufacturers here that may be using those fuels. So there's a large contingent of people behind that who see a big economic, you know, impact from that. And I think that, you know, that the forces are kind of rallied behind this thing. Sunoco has made a huge investment in Marcus Hook to develop the infrastructure to move that stuff through.
And we are, I mean, these are jobs, and this is part of the economy, whether people like it or not. Let me get to Tom from West Scotia to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Tom. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. My name's Tom Casey. I represent the Chester County Community Coalition.
Yes.
We've been working alongside with a lot of help from Linda Farrell sitting next to you. I just wanted to point out again to reiterate some of the things that have been said. That Sunoco has not been transparent with the community. They use tactics that are obstructionist at best. And I've been to many of their meetings concerning, you know, what their plans are, and they talk about is safety. But they refuse to tell us what's coming. And these pipelines, with the amount of fracking that's going on out in the western part of the state, we see what's coming. And they need to to let us know and work with the community to try to figure out better ways of transporting this than just trying to force it using eminent domain.
Well, Tom, let me take your comments and give Linda a chance to respond. Go ahead, Linda.
Hi, Tom. How you doing today?
So, I'm good, Linda.
Good, good.
We can tell you all know each other, but yeah, go ahead, Linda.
And I will say, Tom is the I'll call him the leader of the pack in West Goshen, and these folks are very well informed. They are coming to this project and to this relationship with Sunoco as that informed community that looks at regulations and looks at the technology behind pipelines. In many cases, these folks know more about hazardous liquids than we do. Huh. They've really done their research, and they're approaching this from a very respectful and thoughtful perspective. And I think that's what they're looking for, is for Sunoco to come to the table and have that kind of communication that we had during the Columbia project.
Tom, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. It's interesting to hear the three of you talk about the pipelines here, and to also have in the back of my mind the conversation that's been going on about Keystone Pipeline. Because one of the I guess, other ways, or there are two other ways, I guess, that you can transport some of this stuff is trains. And trucks. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't know whether
And barge.
And barge as well. I mean, back to you, Andy. Is that are these options as well? Is that also part of how this energy is being transported around the tri-state region?
Yeah, the Mariner East, they're already moving propane from western Pennsylvania into Marcus Hook and storing it there, and then either selling it locally or moving it out by ship. And I think the Mariner East pipeline would probably replace about 100 truck loads a day, or it's a lot of traffic that's replaced by one pipeline. So as much concern as there is about pipelines and the safety of those, I think most of the statistics show that they are safer than moving it either by rail or by over the road on vehicles. And we've obviously, there's been a lot of attention on rail safety,
things like that. Yeah.
So and all that kind of is derived because there's not the pipeline infrastructure in North Dakota where there's this oil boom going on, and a lot of that oil is moving into the Philadelphia area, into the refineries here. So the kind of the paradox for Philadelphia is that there may be these safety issues of moving the oil in by rail, but it's also kept the refineries going.
So the U.S. Department of Transportation's Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, PHMSA, regulates safety for pipelines, and they regulate safety for USDOT regulates safety for pipelines because we're transporting a fuel. According to PHMSA research and statistics, pipelines are in fact the safest way to transport fuels, whether it be natural gas, crude oil, across the country, as opposed to truck or rail, and certainly barge.
Well, let's take another short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. Is it Farrell or Farrell?
It's Farrell.
Okay.
I'm going to have to talk to Tom.
Yeah, thank you, Tom, for calling into Radio Times. Talking with Linda Farrell, Executive Director of the Pipeline Safety Coalition, Andy Maycuth, again, Philadelphia Inquirer Energy Reporter, and Katie Colinari, Energy and Environment Reporter for State Impact Pennsylvania and for WHYY. And we are talking about pipelines here in the Delaware Valley. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Actually, I want to talk about the Pinelands in New Jersey as well. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. There's always so much conversation about the Keystone XL pipeline, but this one is happening here, or all these pipelines are happening here in the Delaware Valley. So stay with us. Give us a call. We'll be right back.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol abuse? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia and the Main Line by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at IamConcerned.org.
This week marks the 25th anniversary of the Chinese military's bloody crackdown on the student occupation of Tiananmen Square. On the next Fresh Air, New Yorker correspondent Evan Osnos talks about his years in China, observing the contradictions in a society committed to economic growth, technical innovation, and authoritarian rule. His book is Age of Ambition. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Ordering up economic prosperity, but hold the carbon, please.
Climate change that's fueled by carbon pollution is supercharging risks, not just to our health, but to our communities, to our economy, and to our way of life.
The EPA wants a 30% reduction in carbon. Industry reaction next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Katie Colinari, Annie Maycuth, and Linda Farrell about pipelines here in the Delaware Valley in Chester County, throughout Pennsylvania, plans for a pipeline through the Pinelands in New Jersey, and recent developments in the energy industry in the region. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Linda, let me just go back to you. Your organization is called Pipeline Safety Coalition.
Correct.
So it is possible to have safe pipelines?
In a perfect world.
Which we don't live in.
But yet we can have safer pipelines. For example, the Sunoco pipeline that we were talking about earlier that was put in 1930, pipelines in general have about a 50-year lifespan of safety. And so if Sunoco is going to repurpose the line, absolutely, this is a good time to be doing it because these are aging pipelines. And, yes, they can be repurposed and replaced with newer materials and be safer. But we also believe that there is a need for stronger regulations on pipelines. The disparity between a natural gas pipeline siting and a hazardous liquids pipeline siting. Siting, in fact, has a lot to do with safety, age of pipeline, the materials, the depth of the pipeline being buried, whether or not it's a horizontal drill or an open cut in an environmentally sensitive area. That's safety. We look at safety as personal and environmental safety. And so, there can be safe pipelines, and there are safe pipelines.
Let me turn to you, Andy, and actually just shift gears and go across the river to New Jersey. The Pinelands, earlier this year, commissioners voted against a 22-mile pipeline that was going to, I guess, feed this energy we've been talking about to a power plant in Cape May County. Where do things stand in the Pinelands?
It's a very dicey political issue.
It is a dicey political issue, yes.
Yeah, this project was proposed by South Jersey Gas Company. They're the gas distribution company in South Jersey to deliver gas to a large customer over there, the BJ England power plant, now burning mostly coal and destined to shut down in the next year or because of environmental issues that the coal, you know, the emissions from that. So you have a big investor they put a lot of money into fixing that plant up and repurposing it. They need to get the gas delivered out there. South Jersey Gas has this plan to put the pipeline out there. It also serves as a backup to their local distribution system there. Unfortunately, it goes right through the Pinelands, so it requires approval from the Pinelands Commission, and that's where they ran into some trouble. It was voted down by a tie vote. It drew a lot of environmental opposition from outside of the state. There's various projects that become focus for fossil fuel, or anti-fossil fuel advocates, and it brought those in. And I think there was that's the kind of the politics of it. But what's going on now is that this is a project that had been approved by the Board of Public Utilities, the utility regulator of the Christie administration. They are now kind of turning the screws up on the commissioners.
Well, they got rid of some of the commissioners, didn't they? Or yeah. I mean, I don't know
they're allowed to exactly get rid of them, but they're not there.
Their terms were up, and they appointed new ones. So I think there hadn't been very much attention paid to the Pinelands Commission before, and now it's involved in a really critical economic development project. So, for example, there was one of the county commissioner, one of the commissioners that was appointed by the county freeholders, their term was up, and they were replaced about a month ago, and now you have two more that are the governor's appointments. So the expectation is that there's going to be a friendlier Pinelands Commission there. South Jersey Gas has indicated to its investors that it's optimistic that that plan will go through.
And we're talking about a 22-mile pipeline that sounds like it follows a road or roadways?
To a large extent it does, and there's some parts where it cuts through a little bit through the Pinelands. And as part of their proposal, they were offering an $8 million payment to the Pinelands Commission for more land acquisition there. The thing is that the Pineland rules basically say that no project should be allowed unless it directly benefits the Pinelands or the people in the Pinelands, and that's more of a stretch to make that argument.
And just to add to that, four former New Jersey governors, we're talking about Republicans and Democrats, opposed the pipeline project as well.
Correct.
Just to sort of add another layer. Mm-hmm. Anybody want to add anything to that? Nope. We have callers, so let me get to our callers. We also have an email from James. How dangerous is the pumping station for Route 202? Is 202 in the potential impact radius during an emergency at the facility? I'm looking at you, Linda.
Yes, it is in the, it's called PIR, Potential Impact Radius, and yes, it is in the potential, 202 is in the potential impact radius.
Okay, that's from James, an email. We have Ted from Downingtown joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Ted, go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to say that the East Side expansion is cutting across my property. I have 5 acres overlooking the Brandywine, and the East Side expansion is cutting right across the middle of this. And the compensation that Columbia Gas is offering is far below what the property value is worth. So any hope that we would have of building a second home for one of my children would be virtually obliterated with the presence of this pipeline.
I'm just curious, how much are they offering you? Do you want to say?
$12,000. And this would be for... an area that would be essentially a football field. It's 300 feet long by 100 feet wide, including the temporary right-of-way.
Well, Linda, let me turn to you. Does Ted have to agree to this?
Hi, Ted. How are you doing today?
Go ahead, Linda.
I am well. Thank you, Linda.
So Ted and I have talked as well, and at this point, the East Side expansion project is still in the federal and the FERC review process, and an EA has not been issued, and so he can continue to negotiate and talk to Columbia. No, he does not have to take the initial offer that they provide, and any landowner can negotiate terms specific to their property.
Can they say no? Can a landowner say no?
They can say no unless the FERC does approve the project, and at that point they would be in a position where the company, Columbia, could take them to eminent domain. And in that case, a judge would award a quick take to the company.
Ted, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Thanks so much. Anyone want to add anything to that? Nope. Okay, let me get to Cindy. And Cindy calling us from Fox Chase. Hi, Cindy, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thanks for this very important show.
You're welcome.
I'm curious as to who is going to be building the actual pipelines themselves. And the monitoring equipment, how safe is it from hacking?
From hacking. Kitty, do you know who's building these pipelines? Or?
That's a really good question. I mean, doesn't it depend, I guess, on which pipeline we're talking about?
It depends on the operator. Yeah. Henkels & McCoy is one of the most prominently used contractors in the tri-state area. But it does depend on the operator.
And it's the operator who's responsible for monitoring the safety and operations of the thing going forward. Mm-hmm. So most of the pipelines now have pretty sophisticated monitoring, electronic that they watch them remotely. you know, I have no answer on the thing about hacking, you know.
About hacking.
And there are regulations that PHMSA, that Pipeline and Hazardous Safety Materials Administration, requires in the areas of safety. As far as hacking goes, I'm not sure I understand the question, actually.
Yeah, well, I guess it would be if it's monitored by computers, whether people could get inside the computer somehow. Mm. I don't know.
And I would think it would be like any infrastructure or any businesses that, you know, you would take the proper safeguards to protect your equipment from being hacked.
Yeah.
Right.
Cindy, thanks for the call. We have Rebecca calling us from the Pinelands. Rebecca, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having this program today.
You're welcome.
It's fantastic to hear this complicated discussion.
It is complicated.
I'm calling because I work for a nonprofit organization that has been fighting the Pinelands pipeline. And really, it comes down to how are we going to approach the protection of open space as things get more and more developed. And the regulations that exist to protect the Pinelands have to be upheld. And if they're not, and the commission isn't allowed to uphold their own rules, no one else will. And it will threaten the future of the Pinelands National Reserve. There's other routes this pipeline can follow, and it doesn't have to violate the rules and set a terrible precedent for the future.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Andy, since you've been covering that, anything you want to add? Obviously, this is a voice of concern and criticism.
Right. That kind of sums up a lot of the opposition. I think that people see it's more than just, you know, in their backyard, there's a principle at stake with the Pinelands Commission.
And a precedent, possibly,
Yeah. And Rebecca, you're right. There are alternatives that can be used. And one of the issues in what we consider to be pipeline safety is the abuse of open spaces, green land, green spaces, and preserved, conserved lands, agriculture. In those arenas, the pipeline operator has one entity to negotiate an easement with, and it makes their life much, much easier. And so we're seeing a proliferation of that in pipeline expansions, and it's organizations like Rebecca's and Pipeline Safety Coalition who are trying to help the communities maneuver or try to facilitate a change in that abuse of our open spaces.
Rebecca, thanks for the call. We have a comment from Steve. Could they talk about aging pipelines in Allentown? And Katie, I wonder whether your travels have taken you to the Allentown area.
Not specifically, no. So unfortunately, I don't know much about aging pipelines in Allentown. But I mean, maybe also just to touch on something that we talked about earlier, you know, is there such a thing as a safe pipeline? It reminded me of an interview that I did back a couple months ago with a guy who is a former, his name escapes me right now, but he worked for about 30 years as a pipeline inspector for the federal government and couldn't say anything more than that. But he's now sort of considered sort of a pipeline safety expert. He travels around the country doing kind of similar work to Linda, you know, working with communities in places where pipelines are causing controversy to sort of answer questions and things like that. And he actually said to me one time that there is no such thing as a pipeline accident. That there actually, his argument is that there can be completely safe pipelines. He argues that he has seen them in his lifetime, but that often, he said, what it comes down to is when companies make a choice between certain safeguards and putting investment into certain things and replacing pipes in a timely manner or not. And he said often in cases where he has seen disasters, they're rare, but they do happen, and of course they make news and they make people worried. You know, when these disasters do happen, he says he's often able to pinpoint a choice that was made by a company that may have resulted in whatever occurred, an explosion or what have you.
That's interesting. You're nodding your head.
Yeah, we can correlate that to Allentown as well, but before we talk about Allentown, there was an explosion in Appomattox, Virginia in 2008 in which the company had done their smart pigging. They had all the data that they needed to realize that there was a potential for an explosion, but they never got around to reading it before the pipeline exploded. Wow. And they were heavily fined, not heavily enough, but heavily fined for that accident.
So it's one explosion. Thing to have information, it's another to
whether or not it's timely processed. As far as Allentown and aging pipelines, that's another issue of pipelines in which you're talking about distribution lines. And those are the lines that go from the city gate. After a transmission line, you've got a city gate that puts mercaptan, that rotten egg smell, into it, and then that fuel goes to a very low pressure line called a distribution line in the city. in this case, Allentown. And one of the problems there is that the siting of those lines and the safety of those lines are maintained by the utility, not by the city manager, not by the city utility. And so if in Allentown's case, now Allentown had a catastrophic explosion in 2011 that could have been prevented. So I think that's what the caller was referring to.
Yeah, Andy?
Yeah, I think he is referring to a distribution. That's a local utility. So the gas there is operating at a lot lower pressure. And it's Philadelphia has the same issue with the aging infrastructure of the city. They're replacing it at an 88-year pace now. So some of it's, especially the old cast iron mains, and it's one of the motives behind the whole issue of selling PGW to a private entity.
Right.
Which is a whole other issue that I know you've been covering as well. You had a piece, actually, Andy, about the steel industry in Pennsylvania. Perhaps its relationship to what is happening with pipelines and whether they'll, you know, how one industry might be affected by another.
They would have the steel industry both as a consumer of natural gas as a fuel, but also for selling product. Pipes are made of steel, and so you know there's a lot of. I think there was a French manufacturer that came in and opened up a new steel mill in Youngstown that saw an opportunity in the pipeline market. So there's other spin-off aspects of it.
Well, Katie, we're almost out of time here, but I guess we have to think of this region, whether we like it or not, as this really burgeoning energy hub.
Right.
With all these pipelines and all this energy coming and going.
Right. I mean, I think that there are people who see, particularly regional, politicians and economic leaders, the governor, who see this area as having the potential for kind of being like the Houston of the East Coast. And I think this sort of speaks to what we've been kind of talking about, for the entire hour, Marty, this balance that you have. These pipeline projects, talking to somebody from Sunoco Logistics after one of the hearings, he said, walking around Marcus Hook where I grew up, I'm seeing people, out the door again at the local Italian place for lunch, which you didn't see for a couple years when that refinery closed, and people have job opportunities. So there's really this this balance between energy and environment that is constantly being batted back and forth.
Well, to be continued, my thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Katie Culinary, thanks very much.
Thank you. You're
welcome. Energy and Environment Reporter at State Impact Pennsylvania and WHYY. Andy Maycuth, thank you very much as well.
Pleasure.
And he's a Philadelphia Inquirer energy reporter. And Linda Farrell, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. She's the executive director of the Pipeline Safety Coalition. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. In fact, we posted some photos on our Facebook page. You can check out what our guests look like. I'm Marty Moscoe, and thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.